From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. It was only supposed to be a movie, but with reels and reels of footage to work with, Oscar winner Peter Jackson ultimately put together a three-part, nearly eight-hour docuseries on the making of the 1970 Beatles album, Let It Be.
I mean, I probably ended up spending 2 years longer on it than I thought I was, but who cares? I mean, it was just the greatest spirit was great. It was just like, you know, money and the dollars was not the primary thought here.
Labor of love.
Absolutely.
Director Peter Jackson talks about the joy of working with Paul and Ringo on the making of the Disney Plus series, Get Back. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Disney's results better than expected, all over the place. Strong theme park, strong this, strong that. Beat expectations, adding more subscribers than they had anticipated. They've got a nice big number now. Of course, the aggregate number of subscribers, as we're seeing, is no longer the simple measure of success anymore. We are looking at a world where how much money you get out of each person who's consuming your product is more important than just this many subscribers. So Disney did do very well. And they took the opportunity to sock their customers in the wallet. Chapek is known as a cost cutter and a price raiser, Bob Chapek, the CEO. But in this case, you know, as we have discussed, streaming is a very difficult, expensive game. And it just could not go on in the sort of fantasy world that Netflix seemed to be living in. You know, just crank out more, spend more. Somebody has to pay.
Yeah, we kind of knew this was going to happen when they announced that they were going to be doing an advertising-supported tier on Disney Plus. And lo and behold, the $7.99 price for Disney Plus is staying the same if you want to endure advertising. But if you want to keep with no ads, you've got to now pay $3 more, $10.99 for Disney Plus. And there are price increases on Hulu and the Disney bundle as well. And that's the reality here, because Disney, you know, they're not sad about this subscriber increase. It's a very good trajectory to be on, gaining 14.4 million subscribers this quarter, more than the 10 million that analysts expected. And they are now, with all their services, actually bigger momentarily than Netflix, because they have 221 million subs, Netflix at about 220. That probably won't last because of the India situation, where they're probably going to lose a lot of subs. But given those gains, they've now pivoted to where they're not just talking about that. They're really focused on this average revenue per subscriber. And the average revenue per user at Disney Plus has traditionally been much lower than the other services, partly because of India, where they don't pay very much, and partly because the former CEO, Bob Iger, priced Disney Plus very low to get in the game, to get a lot of subscribers very quickly. And now they're going to squeeze and try to get more money out of each of these subs.
Yeah, I feel bad for the parents who are, it's almost mandatory, like you don't have that much choice. So now your kid is either going to pay more, or your kid's going to watch a bunch of ads, I guess. You referenced India a couple of times. This is Disney, as we have talked about, gave up very expensive rights to cricket, which is very popular. But as you say, the users aren't paying as much. This applies to all the services. They'll talk about the aggregate number of users, but where are the users? They're not all paying, like, you know, $15 in Pittsburgh. Some of them are in countries where it's much less. And Disney decided is trade off those India subscribers, those aggregate numbers, for more return. Now, notwithstanding all of the great numbers, and this is something that I think we had seen everybody sort of jam on the brakes with respect to the whole streaming proposition because Netflix had hit a wall. These numbers going up will hearten some people who care about that. But Disney still lost $1 billion on this, despite all of those good numbers.
Yeah, and the $1 billion loss on the direct-to-consumer category was actually $300 million more than they anticipated. So they're gaining subscribers, but they're actually spending a bunch more money to get them. And that's another reason why you have to raise prices, because this streaming game is very expensive, especially when you are playing it on the level that Disney is, where these Star Wars series can cost nine figures and Marvel series, and you're just throwing them one after another. You've really got to spend, and now they're going to try to recoup a little bit more of that from the price increases.
Yeah, I mean, every major player is in this. You know, Warner Brothers Discovery has the expensive Game of Thrones prequel. Amazon, of course, has the Lord of the Rings related series coming. And these are very, very expensive. And, you know, there's no free ride. The consumers get the squeeze, as we've said. Look at David Zaslav. He said, we're going to be in streaming, but not all in on streaming. So we're seeing him tamp it down a little bit. But I don't know that Disney is going to do that.
Yeah, they haven't indicated yet that they are going to decrease spending or kind of change course at all. David Zaslav's mantra is, we want to get paid. And what he's saying is that, yes, we want to build up our services, but we're going to try to monetize our content in whatever way we can. And that means, you know, perhaps taking some things off of HBO Max and selling them in other ways, you know, going the linear route. Linear is still a huge business for all of these companies. And they, you know, the past 3 or 4 years, we haven't really heard anything about linear because it's a declining business, but it still throws off a lot of money. And it's a big advantage that these companies have over Netflix, which does not have linear. And Netflix describes it as, you know, not being tied down to the past, but the past is still generating a lot of money for these companies. And I think these leaders like David Zaslav are trying to capitalize on that to fund the growth.
Yeah, I mean, they're walking through a tightrope over a couple of chasms. On the one side is the revenue from all these old school cable channels and whatnot, which is still considerable but declining. And on the other side is this rapacious beast of streaming that wants to eat up all this money. And they're trying to figure out how to walk right between the, you know, get through those two forces and live. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. Peter Jackson's nearly 8-hour documentary series Get Back follows the Beatles for 21 days in 1969 as they wrote and rehearsed material for an upcoming concert under a tight deadline. Jackson had access to 60 hours of footage that was shot by director Michael Lindsay Hogg for his own 1970 documentary Let It Be. As you will hear, the Beatles exerted considerable control over what would and would not be included in that film. 50 years later, Peter Jackson had a much freer hand with that footage as he worked with Paul and Ringo and the families of John and George to create his docuseries. While not shying away from the tensions that would eventually drive the Beatles apart, Jackson's Get Back also celebrates the band's joyful and playful moments. In one of many rehearsals of the series' title song, Lennon and McCartney respond when the band is briefly interrupted by recording engineer Glyn Johns.
Don't interrupt stars when they're recording. We're bloody stars, you know.
Don't come in.
Cheek.
And now your host for this evening, The Bottles.
Though Get Back dropped on Disney Plus in November 2021, Jackson hasn't come close to tiring of the subject matter. How much have you been talking about the Beatles? I feel like, which one wins now, the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit or the Beatles in terms of time spent?
Well, Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit and King Kong and all those, you get a bit tired of talking about that, but I can talk about the Beatles till the cows come home, so don't worry about me. The easiest interviews I've ever done are these Beatle ones because I've been a fan for 40 years, so I can talk endlessly about them.
You were too young, actually, to have watched the Ed Sullivan Show, though, right?
I was 3 years old, but more of a problem is we didn't have a TV in the house at that point, which would have been the problem. And I don't know whether New Zealand ever had the Ed Sullivan Show. I never saw it. But I know what you're saying, February 64, yeah.
You were a little tot of three. But you eventually, I think you were going to buy something else, like a model plane or something, but you ended up buying a couple of Beatles albums.
Well, yeah, the interesting thing is, even though I was born in 1961, this is the sort of the awkward part when people talk to me about it, is I kind of don't really have a story or any memory of the Beatles in the 60s, which is crazy because I lived all the way through that period. And my parents were not particularly, you know, rock and rollers or anything, but I must have heard the Beatles endlessly through 65, 66, 67. I mean, because the radio was just playing, nothing else. But so I can only put two and two together and assume that I listened to them in the 60s and I really like them, because when I finally was able to earn some pocket money, get a newspaper round and selling some mushrooms on the side of the road for about two bucks a bag, I had this model plane that I was saving up for. And, you know, I just had to spend several weeks saving up enough money. And then I headed off into the city to buy my model plane. And I passed this record shop. And the Beatles had not been a band for 3 years, but that Red and Blue album, which is kind of the greatest hits in a way, that had just come out, and it had the photograph of them when they were young on the staircase. Then it had That was the Red album, and then the Blue album had the older hairy guys, and my attention was immediately grabbed by those two photos. I went into the shop and I picked up the albums and looked at them, and I recognized some of the songs. So I'm just assuming I liked the Beatles, but didn't know much about them. And so I abandoned the idea of the model plane, and I bought those. So I bought my first Beatles albums in 1973.
That's kind of a pivotal moment. It's almost like something out of a short story when the little boy gives up the model plane and goes for the record albums with the hippies and the social revolution that he probably isn't even aware of. But somehow, maybe I'm writing fiction here, but it feels that way to me. So I feel like, I don't know why, I feel like maybe I had some sort of neurological event. I cannot remember a thing about Let It Be. This is the film that Michael Lindsay Hogg made in 1970. It was a huge amount of footage that he shot. I don't understand how I don't know, remember that, but I don't.
Well, because you were only two years old.
That's it. That's the real reason. Yes. I'm sticking with that story. Yes. Yeah. The thing that people seem to comment about the most, just in my casual conversation, one of the things, I mean, there's much to discuss, is the way Yoko Ono is sitting there, just sitting there doing a crossword puzzle or knitting or whatever she's doing while they're in this act of creation. Mm-hmm. And it strikes many people as, you know, strange.
It's strange.
I don't know whether when you circle back now, I know you dealt with the two living Beatles as well as Olivia Harrison and Yoko Ono. Were they just like, we don't care if anything, I mean, they were just chill with whatever you wanted to do?
Well, there was certainly, there was stuff going on, obviously, with John, because Yoko came on the scene, which necessitated John to divorce from his wife. So that happened in 68. And in 68, when they were doing the White Album, Yoko came into the studio a few times. So certainly it wasn't appreciated by George or Paul. George in particular, I think, found her very distracting. But the truth of it is she never gives them notes on their performance. She never tries to intrude. And Yoko says, today, that she came in because John asked her to come in. And the other thing is that this is January 69. And the other thing, which is not in the movie because we stuck to just what we got film of, but Yoko and John had a miscarriage, quite a late-term miscarriage in December. So they weren't, they were both in a state of grief. The strange thing, I cut this movie with Javis over 4 years, and I became Yoko blind. The first times I watched it, I was so distracted by Yoko sitting there. It was so distracting. But by the time I got into year two or year three of watching it, I couldn't see her anymore. I became completely blind because she's not an intrusive.
No, she's quiet. She's like sitting there.
Now, you could say that she's intrusive because it's a boys' domain, and it always has been, and they always had a rule that the girlfriends have to stay home and they can't come in the studio. So she's sort of breaking the rule, and the others are very much aware of it. But, they are human beings, and I don't judge anybody for being a human being, really. The alternative is that John comes into the studio and Yoko just stays at home all by herself. So, I could understand the two of them wanting to comfort each other at that point in time.
Were the living Beatles or the families of the other Beatles over any kind of impulse to edit you or tell you don't use that, or did they have notes?
I was down in New Zealand editing, and then the pandemic happened, so I wasn't able to fly up to England to show them stuff or anything. So, I got sort of isolated with Javis down there through the whole pandemic. So we were happily cutting away. Every now and again, I'd send a 5-minute scene to one of the Beatles. So like when I came across that bit where there's a bit where Paul appears to pluck Get Back out of the air, he seems to make it up on the spot. So I sent that to him and I said, is this what I think it is? And he said, yep, that's me doing Get Back just there. And so he confirmed what that was. And then I had a couple of funny bits I sent to Ringo, and Olivia I showed up to, and Sean Lennon I showed a whole bunch. Danny Harrison came down to New Zealand just before the pandemic and watched a whole lot of stuff with us. So they were very, very polite. I mean, Paul McCartney said to me at the very beginning, he said, it's your film, do what you want. And so all the way through, I was talking to Michael Lindsay Hogg, who's been incredibly supportive of me and very, very helpful all the way through. So Michael would be telling me these stories about, when he had his first cut. He screened it to them on the 20th of July, 69, because it was the day that the Apollo astronauts were on the moon. He first showed it to them. And he just, what he describes is something that's a little bit of a nightmare, where where one of the Beatles would come in the cutting room the next day and get him to change stuff. And then the day after, and another Beatle would show up and get him to put all the other stuff back again. Oh my God. And change you know, and so I have no, I don't blame Michael at all for what he had to deal with at the time. But so I was half expecting something like that, because the Beatles are notoriously, you know, what's the term? They're not control. They're, well, they like
the Beatles.
Yeah. And so anyway, we finished the cut, which was supposed to be 2 hours, 2 hours quarter. And but the cut that we finished due to the pandemic was about 6.5 hours. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they knew it was 6.5 hours. But anyway, I just said to James, let's just send it to them. We're going to get a pile of notes. I was just expecting, you know, what one of them would say, oh, can you cut that bit out where I say that? Or why do we have to show that bit? Or, you know, I was expecting all those sorts of notes, and I didn't get one note, not one note, not a single note. The only comment I got was basically, this is the most stressful thing that I've ever watched in my life, but don't change a thing. I mean, they actually told me, don't change a thing.
Who said that? It was the most stressful thing.
So I kind of, I realized at the time that it's a moment where history has taken over. So that whatever they thought of themselves and their image in the 60s or even after the breakups, you know, 70s, 80s, such a distance of time has gone by now that they are able themselves to see it as a historical.
So I'll try. Who said it was stressful?
I won't say.
You're not going to say. You're ignoring my question.
I don't really want to record my conversation with them, but that was the quote for sure.
That was one of them. I'm going to guess Paul.
One of them.
Yes, I'm guessing Paul. But
one of those people.
Yeah. Because Ringo always looks pretty chill, but I'm guessing Paul.
And look, and Olivia Harrison has been very supportive too, and because in a sense I was aware that she, because when Let It Be was made, George walks out, he storms out and leaves the band on camera, and then ever since he didn't have a kind word to say about that particular period in time. In fact, he was about the most negative of anybody. Mm-hmm. About, you know, mm-hmm. It was a nightmare, the winter of discontent, he called it. It was an absolute joke, and so I was aware that Olivia, who's obviously protecting George's legacy, I thought, well, George isn't here anymore, so Olivia's gonna and Olivia wasn't there then. You know, she didn't experience this, and so I didn't quite know how Olivia would react to it, because she'd be, you know, wanting to protect George, who hated this whole period of time. But she actually the exact opposite. She's been incredibly supportive, incredibly helpful. She's dug out George's diary for me. We put some of that in the film, and she's been great. And that's the thing, Kim, is that I was thinking the other day about it. Because Get Back, the thing that I made, is 100% financed by them. Disney picked it up, you know, as a licensed thing after it was finished. But the Beatles actually paid for Get Back. So in a sense, they are the studio. And I was thinking the other day, well, they're actually the best studio I've ever worked for. They're really nice. They're very friendly. They were always helpful. And they'd always answer my questions. If I wanted to ask Paul a question, within minutes, he'd get back to me. Ringo, you know, it's they've been incredibly supportive. So in a sense, if you call Apple Core a studio, which I guess if they finance the film, they are, I think it's my best experience in a studio. It was 4 years of fun and enjoyment. You know, it was great.
I won't pass that along to the other studios. Jealous.
But you've got to say that, I mean, the last studio I worked with, what was it, Karen Blackwood and Toby Emmerich, but they're fantastic people, but they can't write songs. At least this time I had producers that could bang out a tune. It was great.
Coming up after the break, Peter Jackson shares why former Disney chairman and CEO Bob Iger was a deciding factor in choosing a home for Get Back. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Director Peter Jackson's three-part documentary series, Get Back, maps out the creation of the Beatles album, Let It Be, over 21 days in 1969. The nearly 8-hour series is a fly-on-the-wall view of the Beatles' creative process. At one point, as George Harrison grapples with the lyrics of what would become the song Something, John Lennon suggests a novel approach to a track that ultimately would become a part of the Abbey Road album.
Just say whatever comes in your head each time. A track's be like a cauliflower until you get the word.
Yeah, but I've been through this one, like, for about 6 months. Attracts me like a pomegranate. Something in the way she moves attracts me like a moth to gather pomegranate, like a cauliflower.
Which, of course, led to
something.
So was it always Disney? Was that the deal? And by then it was not a 2.5-hour movie or whatever, as you initially...
We were well underway with making it without anybody. You know, as I say, it wasn't a joke that Apple called the Beatles financed the whole thing. Then it must have been just before the pandemic, right on the eve of the pandemic, we did a whip around town and we sat in everybody's office. You know, it wasn't just me, it was Jeff Jones and Jonathan
right.
Apple. You know, and we did all the usual players to see who would be interested in picking it up. It was still like, this was still 2 years away from it actually being finished. But those discussions started to happen then. And at that point, it was a feature film, 2.5 hours. And that's what I agreed to. That's what they thought it was. Because it was really a follow-up to Ron's film. It was 8 days a week and now here's them again, you know, in a feature film. It was a year or two has gone by and here they are again. So Disney was the company that we settled on. Bob Iger turned out to be a massive Beatle fan. So he was, which I liked. And I think Apple liked it too. Yeah, it makes a difference if you're landing on with a company where there's a genuine love for the subject.
Normally, you know, it's the studio that says we're putting your movie on the streamer. And in this case, you were like, guess what? It's not a movie. Did Disney just say, well, that's fine?
Well, when Disney sort of picked it up, I think it was literally a week or two before the pandemic started. So it's probably January 2000 or February 2000. And it was a feature film. And they even then at that point, they had a date. It was like the following year was October. It was going to be the theatrical release. And then when the pandemic hit big time, and if the whole world was shut down, Disney said, well, we're clearly not going to make that date. You know, there was that period where all the studios were just freezing the movies and pushing them back and stuff. So we got caught up in that. And they said, well, we're not going to be releasing it on that date. So we don't know quite when we're going to do it, but we're going to have to delay it. But Jabez and I were left alone in New Zealand in the cutting room to keep on going. So, you know, if the pandemic hadn't happened, we would have delivered a feature film. But because the pandemic gave us months and months more time to cut, I mean, we didn't have to, we could have just cut the feature film and been done with it. But because we had all this extra time by ourselves down there in our bubble, we just kept on cutting, kept on working. And when I say kept on cutting, it's actually adding stuff to it because we kept finding all these little gems and nuggets. We thought, oh, we should include that, we should include that. So we were doing that without anyone quite being aware of what we were doing. And then we ended up having to send a cut to the Beatles because the Beatles always had the first look at things. And the cut that we sent to the Beatles, they were expecting a 2.5-hour feature film. That cut was 6.5 hours long. So we sent that to them and we said, look, we can have a look at it. We can cut this down to 2.5 hours, but we honestly don't think it's the best way to tell the story. We'd been working on it for 3 years at this point. And so the Beatles sat down and watched it for the first time and they all agreed. They said, yep, this is great. And then, so once the Beatles agreed, then we had to go to Bob Iger and to Disney and break the news to them that it's not a film. It's going to have to be a series.
I expect they were thrilled because they were going to launch Disney Plus and this was a fabulous thing.
Well, yeah, I don't even, to be honest with you, I'm not entirely sure whether Disney Plus was even around at the very, very beginning. But yeah, as you say, by the time we'd done a 6.5-hour cut, Disney Plus was a thing. So I think they were quite pleased.
I won't even get into the deal making that goes on around saying we're going to deliver a movie and then it turns out to be a 3-part documentary. I guess that's Ken Kamins's look.
No, the deal was the same. I mean, I didn't get paid more or less. I mean, no, it wasn't that sort of, that's why I say it was a great experience, a great studio to work for. Nobody put money up front, you know, or their payment, or we're going to have to renegotiate this deal, is going to change. It was just like, oh, it's gone from being two and a half hours to six. I mean, I probably ended up spending 2 years longer on it than I thought I was, but who cares? I mean, it was just the spirit was great. It was just like, you know, money and the dollars was not the primary thought here.
Labor of love.
Absolutely. Yep.
So let me just ask you finally, are you a documentarian now? I will ask you also, have you had anything to do with the Lord of the Rings Amazon project at all?
No, I can answer that one pretty quickly. So, I mean, look, I'm not a guy who wishes anybody ill will, so I don't know anything about the Lord of the Rings much other than what we've seen with the trailers, and I'm looking forward to it. I mean, the only thing that happened with that was about five years ago, they contacted us, you know, right at the beginning, and said, would Peter be interested in, you know, I don't know, being a showrunner or directing episodes or something. And so I said the only thing I could say, which is, well, have you got scripts yet? Because I sort of would need to read a script, because I just know how hard the scripts were to write when we did the films. And I didn't know the people writing these scripts. And they said, oh, no, we haven't got the scripts really yet, but as soon as we do, we'll send you the scripts. And then so I was waiting for the scripts to arrive, and they never did. But that's okay, because fate meant that I was available to do Get Back. So, you know, I'm sure they got somebody good for the Rings thing, and I got to do Get Back. So, you know, and I'm looking forward to seeing it, because the one thing with the Lord of the Rings films is I was the person that could never actually watch them, you know, like a
regular human.
Yeah, so yes. So I've deliberately tried to not learn too much about this, because I'm actually looking forward to being able to just sit back and see it.
You know, it may give you some flashbacks, I don't know. And are you a documentarian now, or do you want to get back to features at some point?
Well, I love documentaries. It's something very poignant and emotional about getting your hands on footage that somebody else has shot and taking the responsibility of trying to do something with that footage. I mean, Michael Lindsay Hogg was interesting because he's alive still. He's got a fantastic memory, and he and I become friends. So I would constantly be phoning him up and saying, now, Michael, on day seven, you did a shot with the camera. And most of the time he could remembered what I was talking about. So I was able to talk to Michael and ask him some questions and ask him what he had in mind for certain times. I mean, it was also poignant working on They Shall Not Grow Old, because the cameraman that shot that film, long since dead.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I, you know, so in both regards, in both the World War One footage and in the Beatles footage, I kind of just wanted to honor the footage that was shot. People keep talking about Let It Be, Michael's film, you know, which was a product of its time and of the stresses that were put on not just him, but the band were breaking up when that film came out. It must have been awful. But, so a lot of people write about that. But what they don't really say is that every single frame of film in Get Back was shot by him too. That if you like Get Back, if you like scenes in Get Back, well, Michael shot that stuff. So,
Yes, I imagine it was a bit poignant for him that you had the freedom to do that he didn't have. You know, he had to obey the rules at the time, and you had freedom.
Oh, yeah. And his movie is 80 minutes long. You know, if you're making an 80-minute film as opposed to a 7.5-hour film, you've got two very different beasts that you're dealing with.
Well, I'd be very curious to see what is next. I know you're doing an expanded version of this. I think that's...
I'm fighting to do one. Kim, help me. Disney and Apple are reluctant because they say, and they might be quite right, that there's no market anymore for extended cuts. But I know that there's 5 or 6 hours of fantastic material that we didn't include that I don't want it to go back in the vault for another 50 years. So let's just say it's a conversation that's happening, but it's not necessarily a definitive one at this point.
Okay. Well, I'll try Bob Chapek for you, but I don't know if you'll be influenced by me. Peter Jackson produced and directed Get Back, the Emmy-nominated series, is now streaming on Disney+. Thank you very much, Peter. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Kim. Great to chat. I guess we'll chat again in 2 or 3 years.
Yes, come back with the next thing.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Matt Schwartz and Paul Smith, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.